Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
And Chris Casso.
Hello.
And today we have a special guest. We have two special guests, actually. We have Larry Reed. He's the curator and events coordinator of Fantagraphics.
Fantagraphics Bookstore.
Fantagraphics Bookstore. All right. And we have David Natale.
Hi.
Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
All right. So, Larry, why don't you give us a brief history of Fantagraphics?
Well, Fantagraphics is currently celebrating 40 years of publishing alternative graphic novels, comics, and badass books, you know, related to comics. We've been in Seattle since 1989. It started with a pretty modest publication called the Nostalgia Journal, which was later the Comics Journal. And, you know, the company really took off in about 1983 when Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez, the Hernandez brothers, sent a copy of their first self-published Love and Rockets comic to be reviewed. Cool. And the publishers were so smitten by this wonderful comic that sort of reflected the contemporary society in a way that hadn't really been seen in comics for quite some time. So they decided to publish that, and thus an empire was born.
And Larry, you've been with them since the get-go, correct?
Well, no, I haven't. I've been with them since they moved here. When they moved here in 1989, I was the curator of an alternative art space in Seattle, right downtown, across from the street from what's now the Seattle Art Museum. I was a big fan of Love and Rockets. A lot of the comics published by Fantagraphics, Neat Stuff by Peter Bagg and a number of others, Lloyd Llewellyn's comics and Daniel Klaus's early efforts. And I immediately glommed onto Fantagraphics allow me to exhibit a big show of theirs.
In the art space
Art space.
What was the name of that space?
COCA, Center on Contemporary Art.
And was that just down the street from the strip club?
Right next door from the strip,
Okay, what was
conveniently
the
located next to the Lusty Lady.
Yeah, okay, all right. Now things are falling together in my brain.
I'm glad we have a geographical location.
Yeah, well, in historical context, it's important.
It had lots of lights, so it was very bright.
All right.
Where it was.
Yeah, okay.
Collaborated on several provocative events.
Excellent.
But, you know, this space said previously we'd hosted shows by, you know, Andy Warhol and Keith Haring, a number of notable artists and performances. Nirvana played there in 1989. So it was a multimedia space, and we in 1991 we mounted a show called Misfit Lit, and brought Robert Crumb up here from he lived in Northern California. Then Daniel Klaus, the Hernandez brothers, and a number of other artists from the region participated in this exhibit that then traveled to seven cities across North America. And they kind of hired me away to travel with this exhibition, like 300 pieces in it. And, you know, it required a lot of attention. And I ended up just sort of after the tour of the show, I just ended up staying. I think, you know, my title was marketing and promotions director, but really I was kind of more like the beer tech, I think. I don't remember a lot of those years.
Funny thing.
So really good ears, then.
So I was real good at being the beard, at any rate.
Now, would you say that Fantagraphics was sort of instrumental in transitioning the comic book culture from what was called underground to independent?
Yeah. Alternative is a term that I applied to that. You know, my career goes back a little further. My association with comics go back to when I first opened my first gallery in 1978 in Pioneer Square called Roscoe Louie Gallery, and I showed, there was a trio of really gifted artists mm-hmm. that emerged from the Evergreen State College, Charles Burns, mm-hmm. Linda Berry, and Matt Groening.
Oh, my.
I knew Charles Burns. We briefly went to college together. He mm-hmm. at Central, in Ellensburg, Washington, he transferred to Evergreen. Mm-hmm. And when they graduated, I had this interesting little neo-dada punk rock art gallery, and I gave Linda Berry and Charles Burns their first shows. I'd showed artists like Matt Groening, and wonder whatever happened to him.
I don't know.
Nobody knows.
It's a mystery.
Gary Panter. I showed Art Spiegelman's work. And,
wow. Wow.
And it sold a lot of Raw magazines for $4.95, which was, yep. you know. So I was familiar with this kind of alternative comics mm-hmm. Genre prior to my exposure to Love and Rockets. But I have to say that Love and Rockets was really a turning point. Mm-hmm. I think at that point there was a kind of division. After the underground era of the 60s,
right.
They lost a lot of their underground comics lost their point of distribution, which was primarily head shops, you know, mm-hmm, the hippie mm-hmm. Boutiques were all the accoutrement right. of that. The hippie movement.
I spent my formative years in Eugene, Oregon. I know precisely what you're talking about.
It's a head shop. So they went away, and then it was sort of and a lot of the relevance of those underground era mm-hmm. comics, mm-hmm. They didn't resonate quite as well. So okay. There was kind of divide. Art Spiegelman published Raw magazine with his mm-hmm. wife, Francois Moulet, and they wanted to elevate comics to the realm of, you know, high art and literature. And so with the Raw magazine, Crumb took another approach. He wasn't necessarily he wasn't hostile to that, but mm-hmm. he didn't really care who read his comics. And he published an anthology called Weirdo. And
I mean, this
yes,
magazine,
that
I
lovely
right
magazine
here?
There that was highly
the
influenced
first issue ever
by,
yeah.
by early efforts of Harvey Kurtzman, and you know, and as well as the underground era. Mm-hmm. And there was Art Spiegelman famously called Weirdo a piece of shit, you know.
But I mean, I have to go that far.
Well, as compared,
I just reread it last night, so I was
as compared to. It didn't have the production values that Raw did.
No.
I mean, Raw had wonderful die-cut covers, and they, mm-hmm. you know, they took a little more expansive view of the medium. Crumb was still pretty well anchored in that underground era, mm-hmm. you know, where he came to prominence in the 60s in the Summer of Love. But I think he recognized that cultural attitudes were changing. So he brought on Peter Bagg, who was then a New York artist, to edit Weirdo for him and to kind of update it. It was mm-hmm. real difficult for Crumb, I think, to sort of lose those roots that he had and sort mm-hmm. of he wanted to introduce new artists, but it was sort of necessary to I think he didn't want to disrespect some of his former colleagues. So he brought Pete on, mm-hmm. Peter Bagg, who shortly after taking the helm of Weirdo, moved to Seattle. He moved to Seattle because his brother-in-law played tight end for the Seattle Seahawks.
Oh, is that right?
Mike Tice and then became the tight ends coach, and then later became the head coach of the Minnesota Vikings. But that sort of, they were ready to leave New York. They lived in Hoboken, and his brother-in-law, Mike, was out here talking about how wonderful Seattle was. And back then, you know, it was pretty nice. Oh. And, and Seattle did have a reputation, having given, you know, if not given birth to the alternative comics movement, certainly momentum uh-huh. with Barry and Burns. And who's that other guy? Graining. Yeah.
Which,
so, you know, and if, yeah, I'm sure you watch The Simpsons. There's a character in The Simpsons who has the nuclear power plant. His name is Mr. Burns, Mr. Mm-hmm. Charles Montgomery Burns, Mr. Charles Burns.
No. And,
a little bit of an homage. Most people don't think of that, but many people are aware that Graining has familiar references to a lot of his characters.
Yeah, there's streets in Portland. Flanders.
Yeah,
I lived off of Flanders.
In Springfield.
Which is brings us to the current Crumb exhibit now at Fantagraphics Bookstore. And a lot of those pieces are provided by Mr. David Natale's Aunt Mimi.
Yeah.
And before it gets too late, I want to get Aunt Mimi on the phone. Now, she lives in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And David, while you're calling her, can you give us a brief mention of what her connection to Arkham is?
Yeah. Hello.
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, hey, Mimi, it's David calling. Hi, we're doing this podcast thing, and they just asked me about, what my connection is to Crumb, and so I figured I should just ask you if you could, tell us about how you knew Crumb back in Cleveland in the 60s. That's where we're from, is Cleveland originally,
mm-hmm.
and I think, you know, Crumb actually worked at American Greetings. When was it, Aunt Mimi?
Early 60s.
Early 60s, yeah.
He did their highbrow cards.
Oh, okay.
Highbrow cards.
Greeting cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that was the trade name for the kind of cards he was doing.
Hmm.
Like greeting cards and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, but these were a little bit weird, and so they referred to them as their highbrow line.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And so what is Aunt Mimi's connection to Robert Crumb?
Huh?
What is your connection to Robert Crumb?
Oh, well, we met him in Cleveland and got friendly with him. And then I introduced him to my younger sister, and she was a little Rubenesque, which he really liked in women in those days. In fact, he would leave candy in the houses of women he wanted to fatten up. And so they would meet across the street and he'd draw pictures for him. In fact, those are the pictures in the show in Seattle right now.
Ah, cool.
So these were all illustrations that Crumb did for the two of you or just for your sister?
No, for my younger sister.
For your younger sister. Okay. I have yet to see the exhibit. I'm sorry, Mimi, this is Cole Hornaday. I'm sitting at the far end of the table.
Hello.
Hi there.
It's like you're right here.
Well, I'm curious of what the artwork looks like and how many images are there? There's lots of sketchbooks. So what did you wind up with?
About 24.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Well, actually,
yeah.
We do have one here in front of us. David, you want to describe that image to the listeners?
It's the picture. It's the multicolored frog. He's kind of like cross-checked and green, and he's yellow with green and red stripes, sort of crisscrosses, and he's saying yibble yibble and jumping up in the air. A lot of this stuff.
All magic marker.
And all, yeah, exactly. All magic marker. Most of the sketches are kind of from. I don't know if our guests are familiar with that period of the Yum Yum book. He kind of drew these little animals and little sort of froggies and various things. There's a lot of those sort of birds and animals sort of things. It's a lot different from some of the later work like the Genesis, which was just at the Seattle Art Museum and all that. But
this is real early stuff.
Gotcha. So, Mimi, do you have particular memories of interacting with him? And did you have any type of insight?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, in fact, when we, there was a whole group of us went to San Francisco, sort of together, but not together. And one of the things was I was helping him staple the first Zap comics in his apartment in San Francisco. And I said to him, well, he wanted to say, what can he pay us for this? And I said, well, Robert, you don't have to pay us anything. But just when you're rich and famous, don't forget who we were. And the result of that was the picture in Zap 13 with me handing him a joint.
Oh, is that right?
You're famous for introducing him to drugs.
Yes. I mean,
the art world would not be the same without you. And here's Aunt Mimi passing him a joint.
I'm showing the picture now.
Yeah. From Zap 13. Thank you very much, by the way. You've enriched all of our lives. This is Larry, by the way.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. And that's interesting because I just got done reading the Weirdo story where he is being interviewed by the obnoxious stoner journalist from High Times magazine where he says, you know, I don't smoke marijuana anymore. I don't really even know why I'm here. I've just got all these back taxes I need to pay. And so I just need to get this interview over with so you can pay me.
Well, I think after a while he got some bad acid. And it didn't work well for him.
Yeah, that would do it.
Did he stop doing drugs at
I
a certain
so,
point in his
yeah.
life? Okay, and do you know what motivated that?
The bad acid.
That'll do it.
Did his art change significantly after the bad acid?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Did you follow his career?
More refined in his artwork. Practice will do that. Yeah.
Did you stay connected to him? Did you follow his career after that summer in San Francisco?
Off and on. Uh-huh. I did hear from him a couple years ago, and then when the show started happening, I contacted him, and he responded.
So can we talk a little bit about the show and what's going on with that and how that came about?
Yeah, well, I mean, we had had these. I mean, I was familiar with these comics back in the 80s. I think that's a good reason why I'm as warped as I am today. Looking at that. But, you know, these comics were in a cardboard box for years, and finally mm-hmm. I was just like, oh, we should put them in a plastic box or something. And mm-hmm. and then just they've been under a bed in Arizona for years and just were finally like wanted to take them out and, you know, sell some of them, downsize sure. a little bit, and also just get them out there. My wife suggested calling Fantagraphics, and right. I got in touch with Larry and we really just went through them together and found a treasure trove of not only old comics, but not only these big sketches, but some little drawings of like Fritz the Cat on the napkin and all these weird little knickknacks that.
So Larry, what was that like digging through that?
That was really the Holy Grail kind of. Yeah. It was a religious experience. In fact, you'll recall I put them all back and then I said, I'm going to have to come back with white gloves. Yeah. I actually came back with white linen gloves to touch. They were, you know, Robert Crumb, just last month at the mm-hmm. Seattle Art Museum, he showed with Rembrandt, Hogarth, Goya, Picasso, Dürer, and R. Crumb. Right. I mean, he's in discovering a significant body of work by an artist of his caliber is momentous. Mm-hmm. And to be able to exhibit it for the first time, I have exhibited Crumb's work on mm-hmm. several occasions, but to introduce this work to the public has been really kind of a career, you know, a bucket list sort of thing. It's delightful. I really want to thank Mimi for allowing us to see this work.
Crumb for doing them in the first place.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's wonderful work. You can see it's about 1965 to 1967, so you're seeing that signature style sort of develop. A lot of this work, sort of foreshadows some of the things he's doing later. Mm-hmm. And there's just delightful little pictures of Fritz the Cat and early Mr. Snoid. And some of mm-hmm. his well-known characters are just being developed. And a lot of them are just sweet. He clearly was very fond of Alex. He claims in some correspondence to have only had a platonic relationship mm-hmm. and that seems plausible because if Crumb wouldn't is not bashful about revealing everything, so they're just
he was a pretty awkward, ducky guy.
Yeah, still I will say, you know, he's still a pretty awkward guy. But again, thank you for allowing us to exhibit this work. I think it's an important body of work and from a really significant time in his artistic development. Mm-hmm. And clearly a budding genius. His work, as Mimi said, got far more refined over the years, as will happen with most artists. But I think it's always wonderful to see an artist in those formative stages where, you know, he's experimenting and, you know, clearly having fun. And, you know, I understand a lot of these were drawn behind a church with across the street from Mimi's place, right? Is that right, Mimi?
The church across the street from my folks' house. They would meet back there, and he would draw pictures for her.
So people are, you know, we have published in... We published 17 volumes of The Complete Crumb.
And 17?
17 volumes. And in volume three here, there is a reference to Mimi and Alex. And people have known, you know, just a passing reference. Mm-hmm. People have sort of known about this. There's there's a delightful little zine that he put together with love for Alex that there's only three copies known to exist. Mm-hmm. But that was a comic that he did for Alex, and they're just really sweet renderings of these different scenes that are, you know, again, he's clearly very fond of her to do all this work for her. Don't you think?
It may sound like an oxymoron, but he was a very sweet guy.
He really was.
Still is.
We have some letters that he still is. You're right. We have some letters that he wrote to her when he moved to Chicago with his friend Marty Pauls, and you know, they're really kind of touching. You know,
and they're in the displayed in the show.
Yeah,
as well.
Okay. Yeah, and a little weird. You know, in one letter, it's, "Do your parents know I'm writing to you? Have they seen these letters? What grade are you in now? Eighth? Ninth?" You know?
Well, Larry, do you feel that that's one of the things that kind of distinguishes underground storytelling from a lot of other kinds, is that very personal and you know, kind of shadowy disclosure of someone's internal workings? I mean, we've got, you know, like Hate and Eight Ball and those kinds of books that are highly personal, but Crumb was really one of the first artists, storytellers to open those kind of closet doors, peep under the bed kind of thing.
Yeah, he was a master at it, and he was he was really one of the innovators, along with Justin Green and, you know, several other cartoonists of that era did have autobiographical elements, but Crumb's were certainly the most revealing, the most transgressive. I think, you know, during that hippie era, they were challenging a lot of social mores, and Crumb was challenging all of them, you know, and in a very sort of, you know, he there was nothing timid about his work. And I think he set the bar pretty high for artists that came along later. But I see now younger people reading those comics, and they're appalled by some of the imagery. And some of the imagery
really
is definitely appalling, but
it's a bit shocking.
Yeah, I've always had kind of a lot of, I don't know, I can't speak for anybody else at the table, but I've always had a lot of mixed feelings about the work that he does. I always respected his illustrative style and the risk taking that he makes in the storytelling. Has everybody here at the table seen the documentary?
Yeah,
I know Ben just watched it.
I watched it on
last
Monday.
Last week. It's been many, many years since I've seen it. Have you seen it, Nicole? The Crumb documentary?
I can't recall if I have.
You would recall.
Not necessarily. I've watched a lot of things.
It's mood altering.
I haven't been able to go back to it for a while because there's some very depressing sequences in there.
Yeah, it is intense, but I think it's a really, Ben, your recollection is probably fresher than mine.
Well, I don't know. I was having some bourbon while I was watching it. It seemed like the further along it was going, the more I was having.
But what I do want to say about him, is that a lot of the imagery is kind of disturbing, but it's how he expressed his emotion, I feel. And it's how he was really brave and let his entire self out there, and that's actually really rare these days.
Yeah, I agree.
I have a question for Mimi. Hi, this is Nicole. Can you hear me? Hi. I'm wondering why you kept all of the pictures and things, and if Alex kept a lot of stuff as well, especially since she wasn't interested in him, what might have compelled you guys to hold on to the material?
She wasn't interested in him in a sexual manner, but she was very interested in him as a friend.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So it was still fondness to hold on to that material.
She kept them. I didn't keep them.
Gotcha.
They were hers.
Yeah.
And so what does the exhibit consist of?
Well, we have 14 drawings. We have a lot of handmade little early comic zines. We do have some examples of his commercial work from that period that's not seen a lot. For the American greeting cards, for example. Tops. He did some Tops monster cards that and he even references them in one of the letters that he wrote to Alex. And just some other, some commercial work. He was struggling when he was in Cleveland. I mean, he was still trying to, he was having a tough time sort of finding his way. He was young. Yeah, and he married not long after he arrived there. He married Dana. I think they were in Chicago. As I recall.
No, they were in Cleveland.
Is that right?
When they got married.
So he met her
at her father's house.
Oh, really? So she's from Cleveland. Did you know her?
Yeah.
Separately from Crum, or?
Wasn't there something about the bad...
Crum.
Was it the bad acid or the good acid? With Dana.
It started with the good acid and went to the bad acid.
And Larry, was this about the time where he met Harvey Bacar, too?
Well, Mimi might know, but Harvey was in Cleveland, and I would think that they would have been.
I never met Harvey.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that. I remember buying an American Splendor at the Hessel Road Street Fair in the 80s. Yeah. But
well, when I first started working at Fantagraphics, one of the first things I did was a comic book convention in Chicago with Harvey and Crum, and I almost quit. You know, it's like, oh my God, they were so cantankerous. You know? I mean, we're at this convention, and this line forms with Robert after about 30 seconds. How much longer do I have to do this? You know, longer than that. You know, 30 seconds. But and Harvey wasn't much better. But you know, I mean, they were very funny. And a little more than a little bit aggravating, but interesting.
I had a question for all of you. Do any of you have any particular favorite pieces out of the collection?
I like it. There's a couple that I of the drawings that I find striking. There's one that's really fun, which is one of the colored marker ones of a big pig holding a kind of a picket sign that says Farb. Yeah. It's just so. And then there's another neat one of a little gypsy wagon. It's a more finely drawn pen and ink of with little birds and critters on it, and painted on the wagon says Alex is sweet, and it's going through a little wooded glade, and so just some of that stuff, and actually some of the smaller sketches of like Fritz the cat on a napkin. You know, some of these little doodles are actually really fascinating as well.
My favorite was a picture of Paul, a drawing of Paul McCartney.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite piece in the show because, you know, it was in 1965. Clearly, Alex was enamored of, the Beatles.
Oh, what's he ever.
Yeah, the Beatles invasion. I mean, there's a lot of references to the Beatles. And Crum just doesn't seem like the type to sort of embrace that pop culture thing. But it's a really great portrait, and you can sort of imagine him hiding behind a church with this little, 14-year-old girl drawing a picture of, I mean, there's something really, really sort of interesting about that picture of Paul McCartney.
Yeah,
I think that's my favorite piece. And then a later piece where he drew her in color, her sweet 16 birthday card, and invited her to San Francisco. I hope you can come join me in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And apparently you guys did shortly thereafter. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
But it's just a wonderful little drawing. By now, by the time that Alex is 16 with the sweet 16 birthday card, he's fully developed his, the style that we would associate now with Crum.
The dark lines and the heavy cross-hatching.
Cross-hatching, everything about it, even the color is something that we'd associate now with Crum, and it was all hand drawn, done with markers and you know,
spontaneous.
Yeah, just lovely card.
And do you have a favorite one, Mimi?
What's that?
Do you have a favorite one out of his sketches that you like?
There were two that I liked when he was working for American Greetings. One was when Lou and I got married, and it was a card for us, and another when our kid was born.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, I don't know if that one's in the show, but it's a little picture of this little caricature of a baby sort of... with making
a
nasty face. I'm like, I recognized it instantly as my cousin Chris.
Well, Mimi, before we let you go, I really want to say thanks for joining us here at the table. And
thanks for letting me.
Yeah, and so is there any lasting story, anything you can tell us about Crum that might give us a better idea of the man himself?
Other than the thing of his leaving candy around in the houses of women he wanted to fatten up.
That's a good one.
That's a pretty good one right there.
All right. Yeah. We'll take it. All right.
Thanks,
Thank
Mimi.
Thank you. You too.
Yeah. Thanks, Mimi. We'll talk again soon.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Cool. Well, that was great. Thank you, David, for bringing Aunt Mimi to us. So is there anything else we want to say about the Crum exhibit?
Well, I'd like to point out that, you know, Crum is largely known for its very provocative work, and you know, that we associate with them from Zap Comics on. But the show really shows another side of Crum. I mean, this work is really sweet, even though, you know, there's a fully realized sketch of Fritz the Cat, who's one of the signature characters we associate with them. These drawings that he did, almost all of the drawings he did specifically for Alex are really playful, you know, kind of cute. Some of them are, you know, some of them are just sort of tossed off, but they're all really well executed. And you can see, you know, his just this kind of innate quality he has about his approach to drawing that, you know, carried out throughout his career. But this work isn't really provocative, other than the fact that they were drawn for a very young girl. I think they're sort of delightful, and I hope more people can see, I hope people can come down and see them. The show will be on view for until November 2nd.
Yeah, where can people see the show? Where is Fantagraphics Bookstore?
Okay, the bookstore opened 10 years ago, almost to the 10 years ago in October.
On a night such like this.
It's located in Georgetown, which was then a pretty abandoned area. Now it's become sort of a thriving arts community.
Yeah.
Especially right around that area. Yeah, I notice a lot of stuff popping up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'd like to think it's not much of a coincidence. We moved in there 10 years ago, and now it's a very thriving nightlife and visual performing arts enclave. You know, it's sort of... One thing I like about Georgetown, it's one of the last outposts of a bohemian blue-collar arts community that we have left in, you know, our rapidly developing city.
And it really is.
Trying hard to keep it like that. But so it's right down in the heart of historic Georgetown, 1201 South Vale, just off of Airport Way. We share a space with a record store, which works out really well. very compatible spaces, and we share, of course, we share the rent, and, you know, sometimes we share staff and... you know, it's worked out really well to keep the expenses under control, and it's really nice for Fantagraphics to have that public face. I mean, we moved here in '89, but you know, we're in offices and warehouses where a lot of people sort of vaguely knew Fantagraphics was here somewhere.
Right,
because wasn't a lot of it kind of piloted out of was it Gary's home?
Yeah. Well, it's actually not. It's in a house.
Yes.
Our offices are in a house.
In Mount Lake, right?
And not far from here.
Right.
Actually, it's a little north of here, Maple Leaf. But
is it a secret? Area. Am I disclosing the secret?
No. The address, location. The street address
That's
is published
right,
in every single book that we have, you know. But it's in a house that's, you know, in a mixed-use neighborhood. But you know, and we'd have people wander in all the time when I worked there, and they'd kind of look, you know, they just didn't quite know what to make of it. But, and I worked there, and I didn't know what quite to make of it either.
Is that where you bring the interns in?
Trial by fire. Yeah. Anyway. So the exhibition is up through November 2nd. Mm-hmm. We're open every day. I'd like... It's also nice there that we have these rotating exhibitions. So when we bring in artists from, you know, all over the country, in fact, all over the world, our friend Charles Burns, for instance, mm-hmm. will be there. Will be at the bookstore on October 8th. That's about a week and a half from now. He no longer lives here. He lives in Philadelphia, which is where Crumb actually is from. But, again, he was one of the founders of the alternative comics movement, and he'll be discussing one of his earlier works, Black Hole, that Fantagraphic serialized as a comic book, a 12-issue comic book series.
It's all set here in Seattle.
Takes place here in Seattle. 1970s? In fact, you can walk to where most of that takes place.
In Ravenna.
Very near our office.
I just reread it, like, 2 years ago, year and a half ago.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. There's all sorts of references to the Northwest.
That I didn't appreciate when I was living in Wisconsin.
Yeah, you would Olympia beer, you know what that, you know.
Well, I'm from the Pacific Northwest, but there were references specifically to
Roosevelt
culture.
High School.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's a book that keeps going back to print, right? Is that something that keeps getting new printings?
Yes, it's probably, I mean, I haven't.
I think what inspired me to go back and reread it was in the latest Planet of the Apes movie.
Sitting the monkeys were
Maurice, the orangutan is reading it with the kid. Yeah, and I'm like,
really?
They're reading Black Hole. You know, I should really go back and reread that. Yeah.
The monkeys liked it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think they prefer apes.
Though. Yeah, yeah.
He's being particular.
Yeah, for a brief moment, I thought, well, there's a market that we can explore.
Word. Yeah, absolutely.
Untapped.
Yeah. It's not called Planet of the Monkeys. So, Larry, if somebody wanted to find out more about Fantagraphics or about this exhibit, where online can they go?
Fantagraphics.com. And there's a link to the... to our social media, and we have our own blog, and, you know, a lot of pictures of the show. Typically, I don't, you know, sell the work online because we like to have people come to the space and see it, you know, and see all the books that all relate to it. We published all these books that, you know, Mimi has actually mentioned in here. Mm-hmm. Mimi is, you know, this is part from this is part of our 7-volume complete Zap series that has actual picture of Mimi.
The coffee table version.
For those who can't see, it's a huge hardbound.
I didn't bring the entire slipcase.
But that's 1 of 7 that you're holding.
1 of 7,
and
yeah.
What are those retail
for? It's a pretty hefty book.
Yeah. Well, you know, the special edition with signed prints by all of the surviving artists is $750.
Yikes. Wow.
But you know, we do have a more modestly priced set for $500.
Excellent.
So you can come by those for all of your friends.
So all you
the holidays freaks. Coming up.
Well, how about the paperback
out there,
volumes?
You know
there?
You know,
that's
of
more
work,
my speed.
Most of the work is, you know, is fairly modestly priced. We have Crumb volumes for 1995 for the 17-volume complete Crumb. We have we published the sketchbooks series 1 through 10 in both hard and soft cover that come from 1995 to. And that's not the sketchbook series. Okay. The actual sketchbooks Crumb traded in 1990s for a villa in France.
I was going to say, wasn't there a boatload of stuff that he
It was just the sketchbooks. These sketchbooks. Yeah.
That was actually part of the documentary.
It was
by Terry Zweigoff.
Yeah. Right. So, but we published those, and it won't cost you a villa in France to get them.
You just can a month's rent.
And signed versions for signed copies for $75. So that would be $750 for all 10. But we also have, again, modestly priced softcover versions. And, you know, we have a lot of his comic books. And
are there any in particular that you would recommend to our listeners?
You know, my favorite book of Robert Crumb's is called Kafka. And it's just wonderful. Kafka's work can tend to be is pretty dense, and a lot of the topics he's exploring are difficult. But this book is sort of he's woven abridged versions of famous Kafka stories like The Trial and Metamorphosis, The Burrow and The Castle, into a Kafka biography. So it's basically a biography that puts all of those stories in the context of his upbringing in the Jewish ghetto in Prague at the turn of the century. It foreshadows a lot of the horrors that would later visit some of these people in the, you know, later in the, not too much later in this, that century, but it's I think it's some of Crumb's best artwork. In my opinion, he was really close to this work, and other than that, I think Crumb's art and beauty work. We published those as a series of magazine comics that were, you know, $4.95. It came out as a hardcover, but the latest number three is in production now. Mm-hmm. And they're those sort of big boned women that he's so fond of that we see in the film, and they're just lovingly drawn, you know.
I know, I work here. I've seen it.
That one was wrapped in plastic before we sat down at the
Cole
table.
Cole is handing Nicole the art and beauty.
So, yeah. That particular body type isn't necessarily appeal to me, but I like the fact that he's, you know, empowering these women somehow, you know, and he's not, it's not the stereotype, it's typical, you know, waif that...
Well, and there's no getting past just the sensual beauty of the illustrations. Right. And the appreciation of the form, and there's still very vivid passion in his illustrations, and that's what's really striking to me. All concerns of say fetishism and whatnot aside,
There is something sort of sick and twisted about it.
Well, there is, but you know, you reminded me that there's another side of him. Both you guys have, and particularly with the Kafka book, is that one? I don't recall. Is that still in print?
It is. It's in its fifth printing from Fantagraphics, and you know, we'll keep that in print. It's it is actually the best selling book at my. Mm-hmm. At Fantagraphics bookstore, it kind of appeals to everybody, and I think a lot of people who toss around the word, the phrase Kafka-esque, you know, sort of know what they're talking about after reading that.
And I really enjoy his contributions to American Splendor. I feel out of all the contributors that Harvey Pekar worked with, Crumb is one of the one that I felt captured the. Should I say Picard-esque? I'm sure I'm not the first one who's done that, but...
First time I've heard it.
Really? Oh, God. You know, sir, you really need to get out. But that captures that vision of reality, Harvey's vision of reality, that I was trying to explain how American Splendor works to someone and why Crumb and Picard were just the perfect pairing to tell those kinds of stories, just of slice of life stuff that it becomes elevated into something grander than what it is. And I felt like that. I don't want to turn this into the Harvey Pekar hour, but you know, someday we might want to consider doing that.
All right, I'll write it down.
Yeah. I think up to that point, that was his strongest work that he ever, you know, I mean, it was the cross-hatching, I think, became dimensional at that point, you know. I mean, it was beyond just, I think when he was started doing cross-hatching, he was trying to mimic the style of classic comic book strips at the turn of the century when they first appeared. And, you know, they were pretty flat like that. I mean, by the time that the American Splendor stories came out, I think he had mastered that technique like no other artist since maybe the Renaissance.
Did you get to attend the Graphic Masters?
Oh, yeah. I was somewhat involved with Chi.
Okay.
Chio Ishikawa, it was the curator, and we had discussions as she was developing that. Now, you know, I confess I was a little bit skeptical about, you know, how this was going to work. You know, with Goya and Rembrandt and some of, you know, Picasso, some of the, you know, Masters of Contemporary Work, and it was wonderful. It was all of the work was all of the it's every page of Genesis. So people, for the benefit
his
of your listeners, Crumb's
like
contributions
three,
were
three rooms full.
Yeah, yeah, wow. 206 drawings. Yeah,
wow.
And from he illustrated the Book of Genesis, and he illustrated it. You know, reading it for the first time, I kept waiting for the dirty part. You know, he was really faithful to the text, and I mean, it was actually wonderful.
What do you think about that artwork in terms of?
You know, a lot of people suggest that some Crumb scholars suggest it's his best work. I choose Crumb or maybe even Picard because I think. I mean, I'm sorry, Kafka. Uh-huh. Kafka's a better writer than God.
God's work is really dry, right?
Well, yeah. Pages and pages of somebody begat somebody, you know, who begat somebody. Kafka repetitive. Would never do that, you know? And I don't think Harvey would either. At any rate, well, I don't mean to be sacrilegious, but
in
all seriousness, I think the story of Genesis, you know, I just think it's a little dry.
Yeah. And, I think Crumb himself said it's a very primitive story.
Well, I think Crumb actually thought that it was going to appeal to, you know, readers in the Bible Belt, you know, I mean, it was kind of, I think it was a little bit of a letdown, but... it's amazing work that's owned. Every page is owned by George Lucas, and he bought it, and he never uncrated it. Uh-huh. So when they sent it to the Seattle Art Museum, I'll make a very long story short. But he bought it for his bought it. He has a long history with Crumb and the underground artists from the 60s. Him and Francis Ford Coppola,
in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah. Actually put them, you know, supported them, you know, when they were able. And so he bought all these pieces for Museum of Narrative Art that he was going to open in Chicago. Just about the time the work arrived in Seattle, the museum that they had planned to build in Chicago went off the rails because of politics. Mm. Long story. But so he bought it for that, to display in that museum in Chicago where George Lucas's wife is from. But he never opened it. So when they opened it here, they found all these wonderful references to reference pages, like stills from Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments.
Oh my.
And, you know, and sketches and all of these, all of this material that had never been exhibited. And that was shown in a case. And I think it was a monumental show. And again, a lot of the work, all of the work that was in the Graphic Master Show at the Seattle Art Museum was related to print media.
Uh-huh.
With the exception of Crumb's were original drawings. However, his work was intended for the print media, mm-hmm. you know.
Right.
So his Book of Genesis has not been published. Is that correct?
It has been published.
It has, yes.
Been
published. Yeah. Okay. We've had it in the store before.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I got confused.
It's published by W.W. Norton. They were associated with W.W. Norton.
There's no professional jealousy going on there.
No, they're our distributor. We have a close relationship with them.
All right.
And, you know, it's been it's a perennially popular book, but I don't think people that really ascribe to the story of Genesis, you know, kind of relate to it, you know. The style is a little unorthodox for them.
All right. Got it.
Yeah.
Well, I feel we could go on all night talking about this, but we probably should wrap it up. Is there anything we want to say? Any final thoughts on Crumb or the exhibition at Fantagraphics Bookstore?
Well, I don't know. I'm just really grateful that my Aunt Alex, after all these years, got a chance to actually, you know, that people actually get a chance to see these rare.
Yeah.
See a little snippet of this person's life from Crumb's life, you know, so long ago. It's kind of interesting.
Well, I'm glad we could come full circle on this, David, because you brought this to me
like how many months ago?
Yeah,
and, ago. And you're like, well, you're the only comic book guy I know. And I'm like, I'm not that. Oh, dear me. Don't look to me. So Chris and
now
I
now you
tried
have
to,
three more yeah, comic book so, people. Yeah. Four more comic book people.
It's
yeah.
really cool. That, and then the next I heard from you about it, you'd been in contact with the folks at Fantagraphics and we're on your way to getting this exhibit produced, which is awesome. Yeah. So yeah, I'm glad that we could kind of put a button on the whole shebang for you by having definitely. You come on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
And all right. Lastly, I'd just like to note that I hadn't seen the Art and Beauty before Cole had put that in my face. But it does show a different side that I see in that, where Crumb has a real appreciation and love and almost worship for the female form and yeah. the type that he likes, as opposed to the more exploitative that we might have seen in other aspects too. So I think it's an interesting blend. I know a lot of women will go off the deep end about exploitative pictures of women, and he's been attacked for that kind of thing before. But if you want to see a different side, I would suggest looking at that stuff, because I think it's very gorgeous pieces inside there.
All right. Yeah. And that's Art and Beauty numbers 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a hardbound copy over there. All right. Well, that's our show. Thank you guys for listening. You can subscribe to the Perfect Bound Podcast at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email at perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. I want to thank David Natale for joining us.
Thank you.
And
thank you,
Larry Reed, the curator and events coordinator from Fantagraphics Bookstore. Thanks, Larry.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting stuff. All right. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.